You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
Make some adjustments here. I'm just checking my sound recording levels. Go ahead and speak just a few words so I can test and make sure that the recorder is hearing you as well as I am.
All right. Brazil wants to build a nuclear reactor. The EPR in Finland is now delayed to 2012. Progress energy costs in Florida are through the roof. And Areva has a new deal with Northrop, which will rival the Westinghouse Shaw deal in Louisiana.
Well, what a good summary of what's going on. So let me go ahead and introduce us, and we'll get started. This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 111. And with me is Dan Yerman, the creative force behind Idaho Samizdat. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And Dan is a longtime nuclear industry professional who's been blogging since March of 2006. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing good, Rod. There's been a lot going on this week. Just to summarize it, I think at the top of everybody's list is the announcement that Areva and Northrop Grumman will open a nuclear components fabrication facility in Newport News, Virginia. This is the second such facility opening in the U.S. About a month or two ago. Westinghouse and Shaw, which are actually joined at the hip financially through Toshiba, opened a similar facility, or announced they were opening a similar facility in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Note that both facilities rely on water and barge transportation as a competitive advantage for moving large components in and out to customers. I think this is a very exciting development because it shows that the nuclear industry is going ahead and revitalizing the supply chain for the major components that are necessary to make nuclear reactors.
Yeah, that's a very important development. And, of course, there's also some other component manufacturing capabilities that still exist in the U.S. that some people have forgotten about. McDermott has a subsidiary called Babcock & Wilcox that owns a facility again, on a river with access to good water transportation that has an end stamp and has restored that end stamp probably, I guess, about 2 years ago. And what that means is they already have the capability and the approvals to make large, heavy components at that facility in Indiana, I believe. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. I know that Babcock & Wilcox never wholly exited the nuclear industry and, in fact, maintained some of the last remaining U.S. manufacturing for these kind of components. I didn't know it was in Indiana.
Yeah, I have to go back and verify again, but I used to know the name of the facility, but it's a big facility. I think I calculated one point that they have something on the order of close to 3,000 square feet of floor space for every employee at the facility right now. Unfortunately, they're not terribly busy just yet.
Well, I think they will be. And, you know, about 6 months ago, Mitsubishi announced that they would invest $450 million in building a plant to manufacture nuclear components solely for their own line of reactors. The Mitsubishi reactor design is currently in design certification at the NRC. They submitted the paperwork last December. Luminant in Texas is the first U.S. company to sign up for the Mitsubishi reactors. They're going to buy two of them. So they've got a customer, and they've committed to building their own components in Japan and then shipping them to the U.S.
Yeah, now Mitsubishi's facility has got the at least the current capacity record, isn't it? Something in the order of 1,700 megawatts?
That's right. It is the largest of all of the reference designs in the combined construction and operating license applications that have come in so far. Mitsubishi also is the first of the reactor manufacturers to commit to building fast reactors, and they intend to begin marketing that technology in the U.S. in 2012. They opened an office in California last year for that purpose.
Yeah, while we were talking, I took a look, and Babcock & Wilcox's facility in Indiana is at Mount Vernon, Indiana. They also own a facility in Barberton, Ohio, that has an NSTAMP accredited. So they have both of the, or two of the few North American suppliers of large heavy-walled nuclear components.
Well, the Ohio facility has been active for years in making components for fossil plants. So obviously it has dual use.
Well, yeah. And, of course, many things that the nuclear industry uses do have a dual use. Of course, the large turbines and all that stuff are very similar between a nuclear and a fossil, although there are generally some differences because nuclear steam plants tend to operate at lower temperatures than the supercritical fossil plants that have been constructed in the last 25 years.
Well, while we're talking about supply chain, I would also mention that the French turbine maker Alstom has opened a construction of a turbine manufacturing plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, so that they will be manufacturing turbines, which you just were referring to, here in the U.S.
You know, it's interesting and, of course, very heartening to me that so many manufacturers are opening facilities in the United States. And, of course, there are some pretty good incentives for doing that, particularly with these very large components compared to shipping them long distances like we do with some other manufactured products.
Well, I think that's true. Chinese, obviously, with their tremendous commitment to nuclear energy, have talked recently about developing a similar manufacturing capability in China. I think we're going to have to wait and see whether they actually do that or not. They have committed to buying 4 Westinghouse APRs, 2 Areva EPRs, and 2 Russian reactors, all in the past 18 months. And they're not done yet. They also have plans to build their own version of the AP1000 at 4 other sites, but they have not yet announced commitments for those plants, only plans for them. So the Chinese are probably their own best customer for whatever manufacturing capability they develop.
Well, certainly they are. My understanding of the Chinese, having studied their history for a number of years, is that they're acting in a way that they've done before, which is they will learn everything they can from all of those suppliers. And I don't expect those suppliers to ever make very many more sales in China.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that, because technology transfer was at the heart of two of those deals. Areva originally thought that they had a deal with China in February of 2007, and then it went on hold. And it was very clear when French President Nicolas Sarkozy went to China to close the deal in November of 2007, but the difference was that Areva and the French government had finally come to terms with the fact that technology transfer was a fact of life for selling to China. Meanwhile, during the same period of time, Westinghouse inked a deal for 4 new reactors, and they're also looking at one other element, and that's the aftermarket for the reactors, which is not only servicing the reactor base, but also providing technical services. And Areva mimicked that in their deal in November. In addition to the 2 EPRs, Areva agreed to deal with China by 20% of Uramin, which is a uranium mining operation with mines in both Africa and Canada, and also to build a nuclear fuel reprocessing plant in China. So Areva probably has a implicit, if not explicit, trade-off in the technology transfer issue by having these other deals, which provide revenue and also spread them across the entire nuclear fuel cycle, both in terms of mining the uranium on the front end and reprocessing the fuel on the back end.
And that's, of course, in line with Areva's current business model, which is they want to be a complete supplier from, like you said, mining the uranium to fabricating the fuel, building the reactors, servicing the reactors, disposing of the reactors after they're used up, recycling the fuel. They're definitely a one-stop shop for most of the services, although they're partnering with a lot of folks around the world, so they're also quite willing, apparently, to learn and share what they know for a price, of course, which is the right way to do things. Yeah, Westinghouse, of course, has a long history of technology transfer. Areva's ability to build nuclear power plants can be traced back to Framatome's licensing of Westinghouse's pressurized water design. And I've got a book in my library by John Simpson, and he talked about how wonderful the deal that they made was with Framatome, because without really doing any work, after they sold Framatome the license, Westinghouse collected about $1 billion in licensing fees, which wasn't bad back in the 1970s to 80s for that kind of money.
Well, the thing about Westinghouse, I think, is that they're more concentrated. They do have a fuel fabrication service, and in fact, they riled the Russians by inking a deal with Ukraine to sell fuel to for Ukrainian reactors. The Russians thought they had that market locked up, and they also sell reactors. But Westinghouse is not involved in uranium mining, and as far as I know, Westinghouse is not involved in fuel reprocessing.
No, they're not. I think I read an article, and I know that you're a pretty knowledgeable guy about the uranium fuel market itself. I read a recent investor-focused article about uranium supplies, and one of the things that it mentioned in that article was that apparently some utilities who are buying new plants now are getting deals where they get the first core plus several reloads as part of the purchase price. And when I read that, I was a little bit concerned that some of the vendors may not have learned their lessons. Westinghouse got themselves in real trouble at a time when they thought uranium prices were just going to keep going down. And they inked a bunch of deals with included fuel and essentially were, you know, putting a damper on the uranium market, almost selling short, and eventually the price of uranium went way up, and they had to buy uranium at far greater price than they expected to. So I hope those vendors are actually buying uranium while they're committing to supply reactors with fuel.
Well, the uranium market is not like other commodity markets. There are very few deals. It's not a liquid market like, for instance, orange juice futures or hog bellies or the other commodities that are traded on the Chicago Exchange. And the NEI Fuel Conference just completed in Denver earlier this week. I think anyone watching the price of uranium has seen it drop below $50 a pound. UX Consulting had it at $46. As of Tuesday of this week, the price, of course, a year ago was $146, and of course, it's come back down. I think the key issue here is not so much whether utilities are buying too much uranium at low prices. But what is going to happen to the uranium mining industry? South African mine, Dominion, pulled up short. It's run by Uranium One, and said this week they would stop production because it just didn't make any sense. One of the big producers in Wyoming, which is involved in the Nichols Ranch, just said also that they would only go to production at that site, and they would stop some of the others. Of course, you know, the uranium mining industry is divided into a few large producers, such as Cameco and Areva, and a few others, and then a very large number of what are called uranium juniors. These are small companies, often very speculative in nature, but they're spread pretty thin, and they depend on regular infusions of investor capital in order to get to production, and they have multiple properties, and they spread their bets pretty wide. And the current rapid drop in the price of uranium is going to force all of them to look at a couple of things. The first is their burn rate, how fast are they burning cash, relative to the likelihood that they will be able to raise new capital in the current financial market. And second, how close are they to production, and do they want to go to production given the current price? So we're going to have to watch this and see how it turns out. I can't make any predictions, of course, but I think that the price of uranium and the current financial turmoil, both are going to have impacts that will be far-reaching on the uranium mining industry.
Yeah, and kind of that was my part of my point was I think that the uranium buyers have to be very careful to not put their suppliers out of business by holding out for the absolute lowest price. As you and I know, the price of uranium is really not that big a portion of the price of electricity from a nuclear power plant. However, if you don't have any uranium, as the Indians have found, you may have a very large capital asset without enough fuel to keep it operating at good capacity factors.
Now, that brings up an interesting subject. If you don't mind, let's talk about India and the nuclear suppliers group, which
sure.
Just left this past month. I think it's a fascinating topic. I'd like to jump to it. Some of your listeners know the nuclear suppliers group was formed after India conducted its first underground nuclear test in an effort to get control of fissile materials because India had obtained its nuclear technology from AECL under the Atoms for Peace program, and they were supposed to commit to only peaceful uses. When they set up a nuclear device, of course, that created all kinds of problems just about everybody. And they finally come back 30 years later and said, look, we will make a political commitment, not a legal one, that we won't set up any more tests, and we really do need the uranium. So if you guys please, you know, sell us uranium again. That's what it basically boils down to. I realize that sounds simplistic, but if you start talking to some of the nuclear non-proliferation policy wonks, you can get carried away. So I'm trying to keep it in words of one syllable. Basically, the nuclear suppliers group blinked, and after a chop and the OK column from the IAEA on inspection of India's civilian facilities, they went ahead and agreed to allow India to buy nuclear fuel. And, of course, this is setting off a race on world markets for uranium. China thought that if India was not going to be allowed to buy uranium, that that would allow them to lock up Australia's uranium markets as a supply source. They're also competing with the Japanese for this. So now India is thinking of buying uranium from Brazil, and indeed the Indian Prime Minister just went to Brazil, and in a tri-party conference with South Africa, the three nations agreed to jointly develop nuclear technologies and uranium sources. So there's a worldwide scramble for uranium and for sources of nuclear fuel. I don't think demand for uranium is going to go away anytime soon, despite the current price. India's civilian reactors have been running at half capacity or less. The country's real needs in terms of electricity are not just generating capacity, but also transmission and distribution capacity and something that we're familiar with in this country, energy efficiency. They have a huge demand for electricity large parts of the country, of course, don't have it. And India wants to become a world power. To do that, they're going to need energy.
Absolutely. And India's got, when you talk about energy efficiency issues, India's got a real problem. Their distribution lines tend to leak electricity to customers that aren't paying for it. So that becomes an issue when they're trying to capitalize their plants. But the nuclear suppliers group deal has opened up lots of folks who are interested in selling India not just fuel but components and whole plants. And I mean, it's a big country with a whole lot of people that don't have access to electricity. If I remember the number correctly, the average in India is something like 1/20 what the U.S. average consumption is.
Yeah. Also, their gross domestic product per individual is different than the U.S. And the Indian government is very interested in moving into the world scene. Of course, they just diverted some of their resources to launching an unmanned rocket to the moon, which is apparently an effort at prestige building, and probably also to convince the Chinese that they shouldn't be screwed around with too much because they do have rockets.
Yes, they do have rockets, and whether or not they're a member of the nuclear club, they have demonstrated over the years that they, in fact, have capacities that are acknowledged. The question is, should the Earth, the rest of the people on the Earth want India to burn uranium or consume coal? I think coal supplies about 85% of their electricity right now.
I think there's no question that Australia has wanted to sell uranium to India for some time. The Howard government, which was defeated last September, was on the verge of making that commitment, regardless of whether the nuclear suppliers group went forward or not. The new government that came in said, we really don't want to do that. But now that the NSG has acted, one of the things that's interesting is that one of the provincial elections in Australia turned on the issue of whether or not uranium mining ban would be continued there, and was overturned. And so one of the federal states in Australia, which previously had banned uranium mining, is now about to allow it. In the United States, you're going to see a similar issue take place in Virginia. There is a huge uranium deposit in southwestern Virginia.
That's Coles Hill, I believe.
Walter Cole owns it, and he has encountered stiff opposition up until now. And then this past week, the State Legislative Coal Commission, you often find coal and uranium together, decided they would, after all, start to study the problem and see what they could do with it. The deposit is worth an enormous amount of money. It is the largest unmined known uranium deposit in the U.S. It's my view that the value of that deposit will probably change the face of Virginia politics because of the value of the mineral there and the demand for it by nuclear markets.
Yeah, Virginia is a very interesting little nuclear specialty state there. You mentioned at the very beginning the agreement of Areva with Newport News. But, of course, Areva's been in Lynchburg, Virginia for a number of years. They actually purchased the commercial portion of Babcock & Wilcox. And so you've got Areva, you've got the uranium capability that you mentioned at Coles Hill, and you've got Newport News, and Babcock & Wilcox has been making nuclear components and nuclear fuel in Lynchburg, Virginia, for forever. Well, not forever, for the last 50 years.
Well, one of the things that's going on with Areva and Lynchburg is Areva is part of the Unistar nuclear consortium, which also includes Bechtel, and the Constellation Energy, which is now talking about a third reactor at Calvert Cliffs has just commissioned Bechtel and Areva at Lynchburg to do the detailed design for that new reactor, which will be an American version of the Areva EPR. And that will probably add 500 engineering jobs plus other support jobs to Lynchburg. So if you're a nuclear engineer in college and you're looking for a job, pick up the phone and call Areva in Lynchburg, because they'll probably answer.
They're hiring. Of course, they've been working on the conversion of that design for probably 2 or 3 years now, because I believe that although the design is under construction in Finland, sources that I have at Areva tell me there's something like 5 million man-hours of work to convert the design and make it suitable for American licensing.
So you're going to have a couple of things that you're going to be facing. First of all, the two EPRs that are in construction in Europe, one in Finland and the other in France, both, of course, are built to metric standards. And despite the efforts of several U.S. administrations, we still don't operate on the metric standard.
We also have 60 hertz power vice 50 hertz.
Yeah, okay, good point. Thank you. The second thing is, I think a lot of people are watching what's going on with the EPR in Finland, and they say, oh, it's having delays, oh, it's having problems with costs. And I'm not too concerned about that. A lot of the anti-nuclears have made hay out of that, Greenpeace in particular. And the reason is that until you build 4 or 5 new reactors of different designs, we're not going to have construction cost curves that are predictable and reliable for the rest of the industry to use. And these are all still first-of-a-kind plants. The industry has been in suspended animation for 3 decades, and so any construction cost information you have from the 70s probably is at best a reference, but it certainly isn't something that you would bet the ranch on in terms of an EPC contract. So while it's true that Areva has just now agreed with the Finnish authorities to extend the reactor completion date in Finland to 2012, it should come as no surprise to anyone that building a new plant like this with this degree of complexity and with inexperienced and untried subcontractors having to go up the learning curve, that there would be delays and that there would be cost increases. And I think that raises a good issue. A lot of people who are critics of the nuclear industry have said no one knows what the costs are. And this is something that worries the industry. Karen Bird, who's the head of Morgan Stanley's global energy practice in New York, was talking at a conference sponsored by Platts about 10 days ago. And she said this is what has investors worried, that different reactors are coming in at different prices. And, for instance, if you look at the reactors that Progress Energy has proposed to Westinghouse AP1000s, in Florida, every time you turn around, the price of those two reactors has gone up. But Progress itself said, we really don't know what these things are going to cost. I think the thing that's important about Florida and why people should watch what happens in Florida is that the State Public Service Commission there has approved the recovery of construction costs while the plant is being built, so that both Progress and Florida Power and Light, which also has proposed two reactors, are going to be able to bill the rate base for the construction costs. And this will result in enormous cost savings for the reactors, because you won't have interest costs by then having to go out to the market and then make investors wait 8 or 10 years, which they would in a merchant situation, you know, for their return on investment. And I think the rest of the nation is going to have to watch and see whether any merchant plants get built as first-of-a-kind operations. I'd be skeptical. Other than a special case, which is NRG in Texas, which is the first mover, and they believe that their financing situation would be a little different. And that's worth looking at as well. NRG, as the first mover, undoubtedly will also pursue federal loan guarantees under the Federal Loan Guarantee Program, which is not a subsidy. It is simply a guarantee of the loan, and they have to pay substantial fees for that insurance. They will cover 80% of the cost of the investment and 100% of the cost of the plant in terms of, 80% of the loans, 100% of the, I've got my numbers backwards, I beg your pardon. It is 100% of the loan, 80% of the cost of the plant. The builder is on, and the investors are on the hook for 20% of the costs in terms of equity.
Right.
The other thing that they're doing at NRG is that they also have applied for federal payments that relate to new generation capacity, which is a law that Congress passed back in 2005. And finally, doing something very, very interesting. They have gone to Toshiba, and they, as the construction integrator, but they're putting in GE Hitachi reactors. And so they're going to the Japanese Export Bank and asking for investment credits, saying, look, we are, you know, basically buying very large exports, billions of dollars worth of good services from Japan. We want you guys to help us with the financing. And the Japanese are considering it. So NRG has developed some very innovative financing mechanisms as a merchant, and I think that makes them different. But by and large, I think the Florida model is the one where you're going to see the first round of reactors actually committed to being built. If you look at barriers to construction of plants recovering their costs while they're going on, the battleground for that is going to be in Missouri. Ameren, which is the utility there, has filed a license application with the NRC. They filed it in September. It cost them $42 million to develop that. It took them 2 years to do it. They've gone to the Public Utilities Commission and asked to be able to charge the rate base for those costs. Now, it turns out that in the 1970s, Missouri passed a law that prohibited the capture of construction costs while a reactor was being built, and this was pushed through by anti-nuclear groups. So Ameren's going to fight the battle through, I think, a slow daisy chain of steps. First, they'll battle out on a regulatory basis within the state, and then undoubtedly they're going to have to go to the legislature and get the law overturned. I think there's some precedent for this. In Michigan, Detroit Edison was able to go forward with Fermi 3 because they were able to convince the legislature to limit the ability of independent power producers to carve out pieces of the rate base and sell electricity into the market service area for Detroit Edison from other sources. And by consolidating the rate base and building a fence around it, Detroit Edison felt that they had sufficient purchasing power from that rate base to go forward with Fermi 3. So I think utilities are looking very carefully at their financing options and will be making their decisions on whether to actually commit to reactors in the U.S. Based on a whole series of factors, not just what Wall Street is doing.
You know, I think that Exelon must have been investigating the creative financing that NRG is pursuing, because I believe this week Exelon has made a stock transaction offer to buy NRG.
They did. They offered $6.2 billion in a straight stock swap. It was unsolicited. The problem that they are facing is that NRG has $8 billion in debt for other utilities that they have, including coal, natural gas, and wind. And Exelon stock took a hit because Wall Street said, you guys haven't figured out how to resolve that debt, and you want to go and buy this buy the company anyway. So I'm hoping that I'm sure Exelon is a very smart company has a very strong executive team that probably thought of this. So I'm sure we'll have to see how this works out. Exelon believes that their new plant in Victoria County, Texas, will benefit from being joined financially with NRG at the South Texas project for STP 3 and 4. we're going to have to see how that works out. Texas is leading the nation right now in new plans for nuclear reactors. We mentioned Lumina a little while ago. Exelon is at work, and, of course, STP is at work there. They're first. Florida is second. It's very interesting right now. If you put the two states together, there's more nuclear activity planned in those two states than for the entire nation of China.
Yeah, it's Texas, of course, is a very attractive market from the point of view of the revenue that can be generated once the plants come online, because the price of electricity in Texas is set by the cost of natural gas. So electricity prices in Texas tend to be very high compared to the rest of the nation. I think that's one of the reasons why it's attractive. And the other part of it is an isolated market. There are really three grids in the U.S., the East, the West, and Texas.
Well, let's talk about Texas a little bit more. You know, T. Boone Pickens has been promoting his wind energy plan, and he's proposing to put all of these wind plants out in West Texas and ship the electricity to Dallas and to other parts of the state. Of course, wind is an intermittent power source, but what's your thought on where he's going to get the baseload demand?
My thought is that it's going to be coming from a company called Amarillo Power, but you don't seem to agree with that.
I'm skeptical about George Chapman's plans for Amarillo Power, primarily for a couple of reasons. The first is he's outside of the Texas independent grid, and you would need what's called an interconnect. He's actually in the western region. He would have to go through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which involves both politics and regulation.
But isn't that where T. Boone Pickens is as well?
That's right. But with Pickens and his billions of dollars at work, anything's possible. But I think the second thing is that Chapman has signed up with Unistar for two Areva EPRs. They, of course, have signed an agreement in principle with him. Unistar has said, you know, it's going to take some time for this fella to get his case organized. So I don't see Amarillo Power as being part of the first wave of nuclear reactors. It's always possible that circumstances may change, and we would see him in the second wave, but I don't see him as a near-term player in at this time.
No, I do think that Chapman has some advantages. Of course, the financial situation in the world has changed considerably since I made my prediction that he would be the first, because he is a developer and dependent upon real estate values, and of course, everyone knows what's happened in the real estate market recently. But the point when I mentioned him in relation to Pickens is, as you said, Pickens has got very deep pockets, and Pickens just happens to be from Amarillo. That's he and George are neighbors, and I'm sure they know each other. They can't possibly have two people with very large land holdings in an area like Amarillo who don't know each other. And Pickens also knows how to do math. If you're going to build transmission lines, you want to have a customer that's going to pay for continuous use of those transmission lines rather than just the intermittent power from wind, because you want to have the lines with high enough capacity to carry all of the wind, which means that if you're really just dependent on wind, the lines would be empty about half the time, maybe more. Because the wind's either blowing or it's not blowing out there in Texas.
Well, I think the lines is a very good point on which to continue this discussion, because those lines are basically a toll-based turnpike, like the New Jersey Turnpike. You put your electricity on the line, pay your toll, and the customer picks it up at the other end.
Right.
And their price is includes the toll that you paid to put the electricity on there. So you want those lines humming all the time. Pickens is also an experienced financier, and the question that I would have is he's not going to carry the whole risk himself. He's going to want to lay off the risk on other investors. Right now, the only...
Yeah, like the taxpayers.
Right. That's where I was headed. Let's talk about these transmission lines as success factors for new nuclear builds. Up in Alberta, we had an interesting situation developing. Bruce Power bought Energy Alberta last fall.
Is that the pipeline company?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Energy Alberta is the one that wanted to build out in the tar sands area.
A guy named Wayne Hennusay, who's a wildcat sort of entrepreneur, like George Chapman, very similar personalities, put Energy Alberta together and proposed to build two AECL, ACR 1000s, which is their new design, which is still going through design certification. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission hasn't finished their review and won't, I think, for another year. But he wanted to build two plants up there to provide process heat and electricity to the tar sands region. Basically, the tar sands company said, you know, you're 10, 15 years out. You know, when you build one, let us know. We'll talk to you. Because they basically burned the bitumen and also natural gas. What is the problem? They're going to run out of natural gas up there, and they're going to need an alternative source of energy. But they're not going to need all the power that would come from two plants in northern Alberta. But very interestingly enough, a very high powered power line is being built from Lethbridge, Alberta, down to Great Falls, Montana. It's Montana-Alberta transmission corridor. They have passed several regulatory reviews. And if you're going to build a nuclear power plant in northern Alberta, then you only have to build your transmission line about halfway down to the U.S. border in order to pick up a tollway to sell your electricity into the U.S. markets. So Bruce Power's prospects for building reactors in the wilderness of northern Alberta may have been improved by a wind-power-driven transmission network that has been going in for some time in southern Alberta. So there's interesting parallels between what's going on in West Texas and what's going on in Alberta, and I think it'd be interesting to watch these two sets of factors at work and see how they drive towards success.
Very interesting, because I've mentioned to a few people that it certainly would be easier to site a transmission line if you can convince people that it's going to carry soft, fuzzy wind power. And, of course, once the transmission line is built, it can carry whatever electricity is ready to pay the toll, as you mentioned. So what do you think of some of the other entrepreneurial endeavors that want to build very small plants and get away from some of the utility size?
Fascinating area. You and I have both talked about this on our respective blogs quite a bit, and I know you've also done several radio shows on it, so I know your listeners are probably familiar with it. But just briefly, Toshiba has basically done quite a bit of work on a nuclear battery, and while they have proposed to put it in at a remote location in Galena, Alaska, I don't want this to sound facetious, but I think the primary impediment is going to be to getting a nuclear engineer to go up there and service it or stick around and help them maintain it. But Galena's close to Japan, and I think maybe that's probably one of the reasons they wanted to do it. There's a company out of Oregon that has a 45-megawatt light water reactor design, which probably has good prospects for getting regulatory review because the NRC understands light water reactors. Hyperion in New Mexico has a nuclear battery as well. It's a radically different design than a light water reactor, and I think it's, but they have claimed they have a commitment letter from Czechoslovakian customer to build them. Again, licensing and approval is going to be their primary challenge. The Pebble Bed nuclear reactor out of South Africa is developing, but the Chinese announced last week that they are going to take their reactor out of the research environment and build one for commercial purposes in China. I have a post about that on my blog. unfortunately, I'm a little bit away from the keyboard, so I can't run back and get you the exact note. But if you go to the Idaho Sabbath blog, and it's a recent post there. That's a huge development, by the way. All of these reactors are coming in at around 300 megawatts or less. And I think it's interesting to point out that as these small reactors may be very attractive not only for developing nations, but also here in the United States. And I used as an example the town of Greeley, Colorado, which is about 65 miles north of Denver. They're outside of the Denver metropolitan development area. They primarily get their electricity from coal-fired power plants. Well, a 45-megawatt reactor from the company in Oregon, why do I have to remind you their exact
name? NuScale.
NuScale, thank you. NuScale would provide electricity for 90,000 people. It really has a population of 75,000. And basically for around $2,000 per kilowatt, which brings the reactor in at $90 million. But if you want energy self-sufficiency, as an economic island in the High Plains, and you don't want to buy into a 1,000-megawatt reactor, NuScale technology might be just the ticket. Now, there's one other wrinkle in all of this, and I wrote about this not too long ago, and it comes from a very unusual source. Microsoft has chartered a technology development company called Intellectual Ventures.
That's the Myhrvold?
Right. He was one of the early employees and made billions of dollars working for Bill Gates. And he now licenses mostly telecommunications and computer technologies, buys patents, and then licenses these technologies. But Bill Gates has another idea. Bill Gates has this foundation with billions of dollars, not only of his own money, but also Warren Buffett's money. And he has chartered Nathan to come up with a reactor which will not have the proliferation challenges of traditional light water reactors. And so they have gone ahead and resurrected concept that Edward Teller developed back in the 90s, which relies on thorium. And as we both know, Kirk Sorensen and Charles Barton done a lot of work laying out the case for thorium and for liquid fluorine reactors as small reactors. Now, the thing that Gates is interested in is providing non-proliferation-based nuclear power to the developing world. And he's thinking of Africa and Asia. So that people could have nuclear energy without anyone worrying that they would have the bomb. But right now it's just in the brainstorming stage. They have hired a very experienced manager for the project, a man with many years of experience, and we're going to have to see what comes out of that. It's very interesting to see that Gates has been personally involved, reportedly, in some of the a brainstorming session, and is pursuing this with great personal interest. So there's a whole range of things going on with small reactors, and they will probably gain market share. The primary challenge will be getting them licensed by the NRC.
Yeah, like you said, I think that NuScale probably has the easiest path to get licensed because their technology is exceedingly familiar to the NRC. I mean, their fuel bundles look just like light water reactor fuel bundles, except they're shorter. And, of course, all the chemistry is the same. They also have their chief technical officer, used to be an NRC employee. I think he spent about 10 years with the NRC before he went to teach at OSU, Oregon State University. And another one of their technologists, I knew as an NRC employee up till about late last year when he left the NRC after helping them come to grips with their concepts for licensing small reactors. And then he went to NuScale. So I think that of course, they've got a, that's going to be a challenge getting past the licensing hurdle, but I think they've got a path to get there. I think that Hyperion's challenge is they've got to find themselves a U.S. customer. Otherwise, they're going to be pushed to the back of the line. It's great to have customers overseas, and it's going to be important for them to have a number of customers because they want to build 4,000 plants. But they need to get some U.S. interest.
Well, if I was Hyperion, I might want to avoid the U.S. market altogether and get licensed overseas and then just build for those markets.
Yeah, but just like the old song says, if you can do it here, you can do it anywhere.
Right. And, now, well, the NRC license is the gold standard. Everybody wants it. But there's nothing that says for a specialized technology like that that if you can get it accepted by regulatory authorities in other countries and then sell it to those countries, that you can make your case to sell back to the U.S. once you've got a successful track record somewhere else. It's kind of like Broadway plays. The way Broadway plays sometimes achieve success is that it will put the plays on the road, and they would go to Des Moines and Dallas and Denver wherever else, Dubuque or wherever else they had to go, and build up reviews. And then they would come back to Broadway, and they could get a whole bunch of investors to help them mount a production in New York on Broadway because they had all the successful reviews out in the boonies. So if I was Hyperion, I would follow the Chautauqua method of building market share, and I would go out and build and sell my reactors in other countries and then come back to the U.S. and I thought I had enough credibility from those other international sales. Now, this is what I think we're going to see in one other area that's going to be kind of interesting. The Department of Energy has been talking about and funding some exploratory work for what they call the next generation nuclear plant, a high temperature gas cooled reactor, but there are several variations of that. And they propose to build a 300 megawatt or a 600 megawatt plant in Idaho at the Idaho National Laboratory, but funding has lagged, and in fact the lab's program managers complained publicly to Energy Central magazine earlier this year about not having enough money to meet a start of construction date, which is around 8 years from now. Meanwhile, the South Africans and the Chinese have gone ahead with the pebble bed designs. And of course, the Chinese have announced that they are building a commercial plant. And both of these countries are looking at export markets for these technologies. And my thought, which I've expressed in my blog several times, is by the time the United States gets around to building its research reactor, the South Africans and the Chinese will be selling them.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Now, I want to put one more thought out with regard to the Chinese pebble bed reactor. And I found your entry on your blog. It's at the Hunan Group at Shandong Province is building this 200 megawatt power plant with the pebble bed reactor heat source. Now, one of the interesting things about the Chinese pebble bed compared to the South African pebble bed is that the Chinese reactor heats helium and puts it through a heat exchanger to turn it into, and then has steam on the other side. So it's, you know, more like a light water reactor or a pressurized water reactor where you have a primary loop and a secondary loop.
So there is a secondary loop.
Correct. It's a normal steam plant.
Right.
Now, have you ever come across the suggestion from Jim Holm for converting coal-fired power plants into nuclear plants by replacing the boilers with pebble bed reactors?
No, I'm not familiar with that, but I will mention that one of the alternate designs for the pebble bed is direct injection of superheated helium across a turbine, which raises very serious materials challenges because of the high heat that's involved.
Well, that's what the PBMR down in South Africa is, a direct cycle helium turbine. Now, with the Chinese think it's an easier process to, because basically their first pebble bed reactor, the HTR-10, is almost a direct copy of the German AVR test reactor that was built back in the early 60s. So it's a 10 megawatt reactor that has a helium loop that heats a steam generator and creates steam. But where I was going with that is the size of the Chinese pebble bed, the 200 megawatt electric, is very well suited for some of the many coal-fired power plants that China's been building recently. So I'm thinking that at some point down the road, if they're happy with the pebble bed reactor, they may very well be able to convert some of their coal-fired power plants into nuclear plants by replacing the boilers with pebble bed reactors.
That's going to be cost-effective because you already have the turbines and the transmission and distribution infrastructure in place. You're not building a greenfield plant.
Correct. Jim Holm has a website that I'll put a link on in my show here that describes how you can do that. And it's an interesting proposition, even for the U.S., because although our coal plants tend to be much larger, it doesn't, you know, if you have a need for 1,000 megawatts of heat, you can put several of these smaller cores and create heat steam that's of the same quality as what those coal plants were designed to use. There's kind of a precedent before in the U.S. because a high-temperature gas reactor in Fort St. Vrain, Colorado, was converted the other way. Not really, I think it went to natural gas, but it was converted from a nuclear steam plant into a combustion steam plant.
Well, that's correct. And that was because basically there were a number of operating problems, including a reactor operator who, during a drill, dropped the real boron balls into the reactor instead of simulating it. which shut the plant down just as the NRC was coming out for a licensing review. So bad timing on hitting the wrong button there.
Yeah, but that was also going back to your discussion about first of a kind.
Yes.
Anybody who really grabs on to the costs associated with anything that is first of a kind probably has never built anything on their own. Because you always learn a lot the first time you do something.
Well, that's why I think Areva's learning curve with their plants in Finland and France, with their EPRs right now, is so crucially important, and why people should not be alarmed that they're running into problems. They expected to run into problems. You have to be, you know, Areva's senior managers are hard-headed realists. They do not go into these projects lightly. Speaking of uranium, let's talk about uranium enrichment in the United States for just a minute.
Sure.
We're talking about the fuel cycle. Right now, you have basically most of the U.S. fuel is coming in from the Russians, blending down HEU. That agreement will end in 2013. So the question is, where does the U.S. get its nuclear fuel after 2013? Well, it's going to get it in three places. The first is that Louisiana Energy Services, which is the U.S. subsidiary of a Dutch company called Urenco, is building a uranium enrichment plant, about $2 billion worth of capacity, in New Mexico, down in Yunis, New Mexico, right on the Texas border. And by the way, there's a low-level waste dump just on the other side over in Andrews, Texas, where they will dump some of their...
It's the waste isolation pilot plant? Or?
No. It's low-level waste for the U.S.
Okay, sorry, low-level waste.
Okay. The second is that USEC, U.S. Enrichment Corporation, in Ohio, has committed to building a larger plant in Ohio. They currently have a gaseous diffusion technology, which is very intensive in terms of use of electricity. They want to go to the centrifuge technology. And then the third is that Areva has just announced the Eagle Rock facility, here in Idaho, a $2 billion plant. Each of these plants will probably be able to supply about 25% market share for enriched uranium to be fabricated into fuel for U.S. demand by the middle of the next decade. which means that the U.S. is still going to be importing some of its nuclear fuel, even when all three of these plants are full capacity. And that brings up the fourth possibility, which right now is a bit of a question. General Electric acquired a laser enrichment technology from an Australian company called Silex, and they are going to build a test loop in Wilmington, North Carolina, and they are talking about building a uranium enrichment plant down there, which is twice the size of either the Areva plant in Idaho or the Urenco plant in New Mexico, to supply enriched uranium for not only the U.S. market, but for world markets. Of course, GE has a joint agreement with Hitachi, the GE Hitachi Advanced Boiling Water, the extended boiling water reactor, the EB, which is now in design certification, is going to be their flagship product. And so they are developing a proprietary uranium enrichment technology and a plant. And then, interesting enough, they got an infusion of capital from Cameco, which is the big uranium mining company up in Canada. I think it's around $125 million, but that basically is an R&D investment. The plant, to build the plant with the kind of capacity that GE is talking about, probably talking around $4 to $5 billion. So basically, Cameco is just getting its feet wet with $125 million to support the test loop. What you're seeing is the vertical integration of the fuel cycle, with Cameco as primarily a mining producer getting involved with investments in uranium enrichment. Now, one of the things that's been going on up in Saskatchewan...
Isn't Cameco also an investor in Bruce Power?
I'd have to verify that. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. But what is going up in Saskatchewan is that they're sitting on top of all this uranium, and they're basically exporting raw uranium. Thinking, you know, we could get a lot more money for this stuff if we had an enrichment plant up here. Last fall, their provincial prime minister came to Washington to talk to Secretary of Energy Samuel Bodman about getting the G8 nations to agree to allow Canada to get into the uranium enrichment process. The problem is not going to be so much political as buying centrifuge technology. Right now, there's a tremendous number of commitments for the centrifuges, both for LES in New Mexico and for USEC and for Areva. And so any new enrichment plant in Canada is going to have to wait, I think. Paradoxically, Areva is also an investor in Europe in Urenco, and so although Areva is building its own plant in Idaho, they, through their investment in Urenco, they also have an interest in what happens in New Mexico. So it gets a little complicated in terms of watching the players and building the scorecard, but it is interesting.
Yeah, I just checked. Bruce Power is a partnership that includes a 31% ownership by Cameco.
Okay.
And 31% by TransCanada, and then a 31% by another company. So Bruce Power Cameco is involved, like you said, in both uranium, or all three, uranium mining. They're interested in uranium enrichment, and they also have reactors that operate on lightly enriched uranium, because the Bruce Power reactors are heavy water reactors, and I think they only enrich to about 1.5%, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Bruce Power has their big plant down in Ontario, and it's interesting to see how demand for electricity from that plant will play out in a very unusual battle that's going on in Vermont right now. There is probably more controversy over fewer megawatts in Vermont than just about any other place on the planet. It's absolutely fascinating to see how intense the battle over the future of relicensing Vermont Yankee is. Vermont Yankee had last August, in August 2007 rather, the structure which holds cooling tower pipes made of wood, and it rotted out. and they had a gusher, basically, a huge amount of cooling water flowing
out. Which is just regular old water, right?
Regular old water. There was no, the NRC rule, there was no safety. Safety was not compromised, but the pictures were spectacular. You had this rotted wood everywhere. You had water flowing at this huge rate, and it just alarmed people in Vermont, which is a very, quote, green state as far as energy is concerned. And it's now become part of the gubernatorial election.
Well, it does have some of the lowest emissions per person because of Vermont Yankee.
Right. Now, Robert Hargraves, who's runs a nuclear blog called Pebble Bed Reactor and also has a website on rethinking nuclear power, he's done some interesting calculations. He said, what happens if Vermont Yankee is closed because Peter Shumlin, who is the majority leader in the state legislature, has his way and is able to get the locals excited enough that politically it's impossible to relicense the plant. He says, well, we can always go to methane. And he says, well, what we need in Vermont in order to provide the similar amount of electricity per person that Vermont uses now, we'll need over 600 cows per person in Vermont in order to provide the same level of electricity for methane as we did for Vermont Yankee. And that kind of put the issue in perspective.
Well, unless you pipe the methane in, because methane is just natural gas, right?
Right, right. But he was trying to make a point. well, what's going on up there is that the NRC is basically said, look, Vermont, you may think that you have the ability to tell us whether or not this plant's going to be relicensed, but you don't. It's our responsibility, and we'll make up our minds when we're getting ready. Similar battles going on in terms of plant relicensing in New York. Indian Point has been under fire, primarily because of problems that they've had with their emergency sirens. They're doing better. The last test, they have 150-plus sirens. Only six failed, as opposed to a substantial majority. And the other thing that happened, which I think is very interesting, is that the plant operator, Entergy, which also owns and operates Vermont Yankee, chartered a Blue Ribbon Commission to look at all of their operating issues. And one of the things that came out from people who have long experience in operating new reactors, including experts from INPO, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, is that they've done a poor job of communicating with local emergency responders, and that primarily some of the heat that they were getting was the fact that they just simply had not been good at communicating the fact that they were a safe operation. So they, the independent commission, I think, has issued its own report. Entergy has put up on their website their response to it, and I think some of the pardon the expression, some of the steam is going out of the dispute over Indian Point, although I suspect that the relicensing process will continue to be noisy. The issue.
Okay, well, I've got to take advantage of the segue you're offering me, because Entergy is working hard to communicate with people who listen to podcasts, for example. Entergy is purchase some advertising time on this podcast itself to try to get people to understand a little bit more about what nuclear power can do, and particularly some of the job opportunities that are available, because Entergy's got several plants and getting ready to split off their nuclear generation up in the Northeast into a company called Enexis, and they're looking for people. So if you're interested in a career in nuclear power, go to nuclearenergycareers.com. Now, back to you, Dan.
Okay. For that, anyway, thanks for the message from the sponsor. I didn't they were sponsoring your show. Congratulations on being such a high-quality sponsor for the show. The thing about Vermont that Hargraves has also pointed out is that if they close Vermont Yankee, Bruce Power up in Ontario is happy to sell them all the electricity they want. You know, it's not. They'd still be getting nuclear energy. It just wouldn't be in their state. And this creates a kind of an interesting segue out back out in the West. California, of course, has banned nuclear power plants, new nuclear power plants within the state for the past 30 years. And in June of 2007, the State Public Utilities Commission, that's not its precise name, held a series of hearings which decided to continue the ban. Problem is, California needs a lot of electricity, and it's likely that they're going to have to buy either new coal-fired electricity or electricity from nuclear plants that are built outside of California. And where they've, where some people have tried to go is Utah. And this comes back to the Florida model and the battle over whether or not the rate base should support construction costs while the plant's being built, or whether forcing the operator to become a merchant and carry the investment load until they start going into revenue service. What happened up in Utah is very fascinating. Two state legislators got it in mind that they would convince the legislature to allow the rate base to guarantee the cost of construction of the plant, even though the bulk of electricity would probably be sold to California, which raised huge equity issues for people in Utah, and which resulted in the legislature not buying it. But the battle there was started, actually, by California. There's a coal-fired power plant, 900-megawatt coal-fired power plant called Intermountain Unit Number 3, which was proposed to be built. And the city of Los Angeles, which was going to be the primary investor, backed off. They said, oh, well, we can't buy any more electricity that generates greenhouse gases. So we are taking our 55% share of Intermountain Power Plant, and we're going home. We're taking our bat and ball and leaving the field, which killed the plant, basically. And now Los Angeles has to figure out, since they are you know, not going to invest in global warming facilities, where the electricity is going to come from to keep the lights on in Tinseltown. I find it fascinating that they went right back to Utah and tried to get the Utah rate base to guarantee the construction of a 3,000-megawatt nuclear facility that would then ship the bulk of its power down to Los Angeles. And my reaction to that is, hey, Los Angeles, if you want a nuclear power plant in Utah or anywhere else, your taxpayers and your property owners need to get skin in the game and guarantee the financing for this thing and not try and shove it off on the tiny, relatively tiny population of Utah or other western states. So equity issues start to emerge that are pretty fascinating when you start talking about crossing state borders and where the power is going to come from.
It is a fascinating thing to watch, and you're doing a great job on Idaho Samizdat trying to keep all this information flowing. I read it religiously, and I recommend it highly. I want to give the URL for those who may not know it, and I'll also put a link in the show notes, but not everybody goes to those on a regular basis. Dan?
Yes.
That's the URL for Idaho.
URL.
Okay. Yeah.
Just to use Pilot Talk, Delta, Juliet, Yankee, Sierra, Romeo, Victor, DJYSRV.blogspot.com, or just plug in Idaho Samizdat to your favorite Google search bar, and it'll pop right up.
Yeah, and Samizdat is S-A-M-I-Z-D-A-T, I believe.
It's an interesting story about this. Maybe we can kind of close on this little folk story. Samizdat is Russian for folk writing. And Samizdat was the way that Russian dissidents, including some of the nuclear scientists who were interested in non-proliferation issues, used to communicate. Because under the former communist regime, printing presses were strictly controlled, and there was no way to reliably duplicate material. You couldn't get a mimeograph machine. You couldn't get a printing press. And so what the nuclear scientists did is that they wrote up their stuff using five pieces of carbon paper. And when you receive one of these Samizdat publications, it was your responsibility to retype them with five carbons and send it out to five people. And so this stuff flowed all over Russia as carbon copies until finally with the fall of the Soviet regime, the more reliable methods of reproduction became more widely available. So I named the blog Idaho Samizdat because a blog is folk writing. It is not the news media. It is not representing of any agency or advocacy group. It is simply an independent blog, and it's just me doing my best to try and write about this stuff. And it, since it's duplicated by electrons in the same way that carbons were duplicated by people typing it, I thought it was an appropriate name, and that's why I chose it.
That's a terrific story, Dan. I had never heard that before, and I am very impressed with the heritage, and I think that the blog and what the efforts that you and folks like Kurt Sorensen and Charles Barton and Dave Bradish and a few others who are out just blogging. Of course, Dave's a little bit different category, but you know, there's so much really interesting information about nuclear power and nuclear technologies that I'm just glad there's some people out who are working hard to share it. So thank you very much for spending the time with me tonight. I learned a lot, and I hope all of you did as well. So
just let me say that it was a pleasure to be on your radio show. This is my second time being on your show, Rod. And I hope that the circumstances permit, we can talk again in the future when there's enough stuff that's generated. I think we're all struggling to keep up with this. I do want to mention the other bloggers who are out there. Charles Barton has Nuclear Green, and Kirk Sorensen has Energy from Thorium. Dave Walters is also out there. He writes on the Daily Kos and has his own blog as well. And if you follow all these blogs, we have a tradition, which I know, Rod, you just briefly revived, of mentioning other bloggers as they appear, and we borrowed this wholesale from NEI, which is another blogger for nuclear energy. And so if you watch our blogs from time to time, we'll put a note up there, and we've created this tradition of highlighting new bloggers who come online and write about nuclear energy. There's also Atom Watch, which is basically located up in Stockholm, I think. But they have a group of bloggers who are starting to keep track primarily of the news media coverage of nuclear energy, but it's also worth watching. So there are other bloggers for nuclear energy, and we all are pursuing our passion for this energy source, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, and speaking of another blogger for nuclear energy, just to mention, one of the newest is Channeling the Strong Force. It's mentioned on Luke Weston's Physical Insights blog, using the title that Dan mentioned, another blogger for nuclear energy. So with that, have a great whatever time of day it is that you're listening to this.
Thank you, Rod.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.